Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is veteran Hollywood screenwriter and historian Michael Druxman. Michael's credits include the movies Cheyenne Warrior with Kelly Preston, Dillinger and Capone starring Martin Sheen, and The Doorway with Roy Scheider, which he actually also directed. Michael is the author of 13 published books. His works include biographies, film histories, two novels, and a book on writing that has been used as a textbook in several colleges. He has written several feature films, episodic television, and documentaries. And The Hollywood Legends is a series of one-person, two-act plays and musicals by Michael that explores the life and times of some of filmdom's most glittering personalities. Michael is also a prolific playwright, with his one-person play, Jolson, having numerous productions around the country. So Michael has just published the humorous Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from the Secret Files of Harry Pennypacker, which he is here to talk about today, among other tidbits of his very fascinating life. So aside from promoting his new book, he is currently writing a book of memoirs about his Hollywood years. And Michael and his wife, Sandy, have just recently moved from their longtime home in Los Angeles to the beautiful city of Austin, Texas. And I would just like to welcome you to the program, Michael.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, great. So you are really a very prolific writer. I'd love to hear where this whole life of yours as a writer began.
My wife is a writer. That's interesting. Well, actually, I didn't start writing for serious probably until the 70s.
But, mm-hmm.
And I never really thought that I would ever become a writer, although an astrologer told me when I was 18 that I would become a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't start writing probably until I was in my early 30s.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
I think there were two influences. First of all, my father loved to tell stories. In fact, when I was 5 years old, he self-published a book called The Frog, the Dog, and a Hog that was sitting on the log, and he self-published it, and he was a jeweler, and he gave it away in his jewelry store.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it was a kid's story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when I was growing up, we used to spend our summers in a place called, I'm from Seattle originally,
mm-hmm.
but we used to spend our summers in a place called Soap Lake, Washington, and there was a man there, I guess he was into his 60s, we called him the story man, and kids would follow him everywhere, and he'd tell the girls stories of Snow White and Cinderella. He'd tell the boys stories about Jesse James and Billy the Kid, you know. And he claimed that when he was a child, he worked in the Buffalo Bill Circus. And,
uh-huh.
I mean, this image of this man has always stayed with me. In fact, I made him a major character in my first novel, which was called Nobody Drowns in Mineral Lake,
mm-hmm.
which is a pseudonym for Soap Lake. I think those were my influences, but I didn't start actually writing for serious until the early 70s.
Well, you obviously had that gift, that skill was there.
You know something? I think it is a gift. I think it's intuitive.
Yeah.
Because I've never taken a lesson in screenplay writing or anything like that. But, you know, I have a friend, an actress friend who's now retired by the name of Diane McBain, who was very hot back in the 60s, was a major ingenue star.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was writing my screenplays, you know, she would be my sounding board. I'd call her up and read her this stuff, and if she laughed, I knew it was funny, you know. And one day she said to me, it's amazing, she had just read one of these books on how to write a screenplay, how you've hit the plot point, you know, like you're supposed to have a turning point in your script at such and such a page and another turning point on another page. She says, you hit all these pages. I said, why did you tell me that?
Yeah.
Now you have made me aware of the process.
Aware, right.
When it was, I think I learned it just by going to movies. And you know, I love film, and
yeah.
just watching movies growing up. And
That was your education.
The process.
Yeah.
Just watching it, it became inherent, intuitive to me.
So Hollywood wasn't always the goal for you.
Oh, it always was.
It was.
It always. I mean, when I was, I think 4 or 5, my mother took me to see Pinocchio.
Oh.
And it was a re-release.
Mm-hmm.
And this is back in the mid-40s. And I remember him saying, "Hey, diddly dee, an actor's life for me." And I was stuck. At that point, there was no way I was not going to go. You know, of course, as a kid, you wanted to be a star. You know, you wanted to be John Wayne or Errol Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, eventually I wanted to direct. And then I realized that the only real, and a lot of people are going to hate me for saying this, but the only really creative part of making a movie or a play is the writer. Everything else is interpretation.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I got into writing, how I decided to start writing. I started writing the movie books, you know, biographies of stars and things like that, and I got tired of that, and then I went into the one-person plays, and it took me, after I started writing seriously, it took me, I think, 10 years before I sold my first screenplay.
And that was your break into Hollywood?
Actually, it almost was the death knell for my break into Hollywood, because, you know, it had a release from a major independent, and it played, you know, it played in theaters and all that, but it was totally rewritten by badly rewritten by the director producer, and I thought that was going to be the end of my career. But then, like a year or so later, Roger Corman bought a couple of my scripts, and he gave me a very, very good writing career for many, many years. I wrote 6 pictures for him, and several scripts that, for various reasons, didn't get made. But you know, I did a lot of writing for him.
So, what was that year of the original?
The first, I think it was released in 1989 or 90. It was called, and thank God it's not out on DVD.
No, it's not. I was going to ask you.
No, it did come out on LaserDisc and VHS, but it was shot in Texas. It was shot in Galveston.
Uh-huh.
And it was called Keaton's Cop, and it starred Lee Majors, Abe Vigoda, and Don Rickles.
Oh, my gosh, what a cast.
Yeah, and June Wilkinson.
Wow. So when you come up with an idea, Michael, how do you know which direction to channel it in into either a book or a play or a screenplay?
I think it depends on the scope of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
I find the easiest thing for me to write is a screenplay because you don't have to do, yes, you have to do research, but you don't have to do the minute. In other words, if I'm going to write a Western. I can learn my basic information on, you know, the historical stuff and put it in but I can do it in broad strokes in a screenplay. If I'm writing that as a novel, I have to have every little detail. And so the screenplays are easier.
Mm-hmm.
But it really depends on the scope of the story.
Mm-hmm.
What form it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. And for all of your writing, are you basically putting the audience first in your writing, or are you just doing it for the pleasure of writing?
If I don't think there's an audience for it, I don't
mm-hmm.
waste my time with it.
Mhm. Mhm.
You know,
it's
a waste of time.
Yeah.
That's quite frankly, and I mean, there's a lot of beautiful poetry out there, but poetry doesn't sell. So I don't write poetry. I've written lyrics,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, this is how I make my living.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a career writer, so
right.
Hey, for sure. So tell me how this whole Pennypacker project came about.
People always ask me that. You know something? People ask me, where do you get your ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times I just say, I don't know. They come to me. You know, certain ones I can pinpoint where the idea came from. This one, there were a lot of influences. This really started out as a screenplay. I wanted to make a mockumentary.
Okay.
You know, like a Waiting for Guffman, or you know, which
yep.
is a mockumentary, or Best in Show, or things like that. And there was this is when high def first started to come in,
mm-hmm.
and they made movie. Were making movies like Blair Witch Project,
mm-hmm.
which was shot on basically video,
right?
High def video.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking they're making. You know, you need a project. Of course, today high def, you can't almost can't tell the difference between film if you've got a good cinematographer. But back then, obviously, if you're going to do high def, it should be a project that looks like it belongs in high def. It should look like a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to do a straight documentary. And, you know, I don't remember how the concept came up, but I started it as a mockumentary script and then decided to turn it into a book.
Which is morphed into a book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where the initial thought came from, I know where some of the influences as I started writing the tabloid press, you know, to make fun of the tabloid press, yellow journalism, but because I'd, you know, done research into, you know, and had experience with them through, you know, National Enquirer and all that sort of stuff as a publicist,
mm-hmm.
you know, but where the actual idea to make fun of the Hollywood legends came from, I have no idea.
So who was this Harry Pennypacker? I mean, the name sounds kind of familiar.
Well, Harry Pennypacker was a revered newspaper columnist back in Hollywood's golden era. He was a colleague of Walter Winchell and Luella Parsons, Hedda Hopper. But you're wondering why you've never heard of him, really, or you're really not familiar with the name.
No.
Right? Well, that's because nobody ever ran his columns.
Oh.
His stories were so sensational, so shocking, so outrageous, they could have rewritten when they rewrite history. And, frankly, the newspaper editors were afraid of the stories. They were afraid of being sued. Mm-hmm. And so they buried the stories. But Harry was under a ironclad contract, and they couldn't fire him. So they just gave him busy work to do.
Let him kept writing and just...
Yeah, you know, they had him write the TV listings and things like that, you know, to earn his salary. But, you know, and whenever he came up with one of these fantastic stories, you know, I mean, they're so... outrageous, you won't believe them.
They're really incredible. I mean,
yes.
This is a real interesting compilation of stories.
Yeah, and I can't vouch for their authenticity. All I know is they're good stories because, you know, when these stories were brought to me, all of the sources, including Harry Pennypacker, were dead.
Oh, and no relatives? No
relatives, nothing, you know.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, some of the things shocked me. I mean, the relationship between Harpo Marx and J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, is unbelievable.
And the Marilyn Monroe?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I know, you know, having lived in Hollywood for 45 years, I can't tell you the number of people who swear that they slept with Marilyn.
Right.
Boy, are they in for a shock.
Yeah. That is so funny. So really, this book could really burst the bubble.
Absolutely.
Then. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, legends will fall.
That's very tantalizing.
Yes.
And there's even a story in there I've heard about the Wizard of Oz.
Yep. Yep. According to Harry Pennypacker, the movie was actually shot on location, not in the studio. Shot on the actual location. Unfortunately, the location was destroyed. It was a plot by the U.S. government at the end of World War II, and the location was destroyed. It's terrible what happened.
What an incredible story.
Yes.
So was the tabloid press for you always... you know, kind of that monkey on your back when you were in Hollywood? Did you get it tied up in all of that?
Well, I was a publicist, so I had
mm-hmm.
to deal with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you want to work with them because they write a good story on your client, but sometimes, I'll tell you something, I have a very good friend, an actor, whose son committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
It was a drug thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know anything about it. You know, I talked to the guy a couple times, you know, a week, but, you know, I hadn't talked to him in a couple of days. And all of a sudden I get a phone call from somebody, I think it was National Enquirer, wanting to know, you know, get some information about the boy. And I said, well, why don't you, and I didn't know what he was, you know, I told him anything, little I knew. He said, you haven't heard about this yet. And I said, what, you know, that's died of a drug overdose. Mm. Actually, I think it wasn't suicide. It was an accident, you know. And, you know, they're so slimy. I mean, look at, you know, if you go to the market the last, you know, say Patrick Swayze's Last Days, Sad Days.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Let the people, you know, Farrah Fawcett's Last Days.
Yeah. Just let them live their lives.
Let them live their lives. Give them their privacy.
Yeah.
But, you know, when many years ago I was researching a book on the William Desmond Taylor murder, which was a famous, took place in 1922 in Hollywood and still unsolved. He was a director at Paramount, The Silent Days, and it was a big scandal back then. It destroyed the career of two major stars, and like I say, the case has never been solved. But I was researching the possibility of doing a book, and I started going through all the newspaper. Go down the library and go through all the newspapers. And they kept that story alive for years because anything, any little crime that took place within 5 miles of where the murder took place, there's a liquor store robbery. Police wonder if it has to do with the Taylor.
Yeah.
You know, and that's tabloid press. That's yellow journalism. And
yeah.
So I have fun. I have a, you know, with them in this, you know.
Yeah. So at this point, what do you think with Harry Pennypacker, what do you think he would say about his stories finally coming to light?
Well, I think he'd say, it's about time. I just wish I was here to collect the royalties.
Yeah, I bet. Famous after his death.
Yes. Well, I knew there was, and I can't think of his name, but there was some writer, he wrote thrillers several years ago, and none of them did that well. And after he died, two or three of them got picked up and made into movies.
Huge. That's so unfair.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, his hopefully he had a family and they profited from it.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So you really are considered a storyteller, aren't you?
Well, I think when I go, and I hope it's not for a long, long time, on my gravestone, I would love to have him write, he could spin a good yarn.
Mm-hmm. So for you, what really makes for an effective storyteller?
Knowledge of structure, how to tell a story,
mm-hmm.
how to make it humorous, how to keep. First of all, you need a good story. You need to know how to tell it. You need to know what good story structure is.
Who your audience is.
Who your audience is. Obviously, you don't go tell a story about physicists to people who are interested in the movies. You know, or the stories about amoebas. you pick your audience. And, you know, my audience for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is people who love movies.
Mm-hmm.
And stories about old Hollywood and
the golden era.
I mean, there's stories in there on John Wayne and Elvis Presley, Gable, the Marx Brothers, Marilyn, W.C. Fields and Mae West. James Dean, that's a shocker.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a shocker. You know, you think he was killed in that automobile crash? Think again.
So how many of these oldies, these golden era actors, did you meet?
Yeah, the only one I actually ever, I saw John Wayne in person a few times.
Mm-hmm. What a stoic man.
Yeah, I love John Wayne movies. You know, he was great.
Yeah.
And although I did like Randolph Scott better. I must say.
Oh, okay.
You know, for cowboy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a John Wayne fan.
Mm-hmm.
I did see him, you know, and I never actually met him. Elvis I did encounter. Well, my first professional job in show business, I was a junior, between my junior and senior year in college at the University of Washington. It was during the summer of 62. The Seattle World's Fair was in progress.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis Presley came to Seattle to make a movie called It Happened at the World's Fair. And one day, you know, they were calling for extras. And one day I had nothing better to do. I went down and applied, $10 on a box lunch.
Right.
So I was going to be an extra. And I didn't really care about the $10 or the box lunch. When that movie came out, I wanted to be able to pick myself out on the screen. Obviously, they don't train the cameras on the extras. So the only way that I was going to be able to accomplish that is I had to be close to Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, the assistant director was not a big help, and he kept sticking me way in the background so I'd look like a human ant. And then he'd go, you know.
You were filler.
I'm filler. Yeah. So then he would go and set up the rest of the shot. And it takes maybe, you know, some, a scene like that, it probably takes a half hour to an hour to set up a major shot, mm-hmm. you know, with extras and all that. So while he's elsewhere, I work my way up. You know, start working my way
incognito.
Up. Incognito. Incognito. Oh, sort of sauntering along. I
That's
said, what's
funny.
The worst that could happen? It's like they kick me off the picture and
right.
I make $10.
Right.
So I worked my way up, and there were several scenes where I was standing right next to Elvis. And in one scene, we're waiting for the scene to start, and he's like 5 feet away from me, and we start talking, and we're having a nice little chat. And
were you nervous talking to Elvis?
No. I would be nervous talking because Elvis was a contemporary.
Mm.
I was never an Elvis fan.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, he was dead at the time. But had I met, you know, I mean, well, I'll tell you what, later on, I met Edward G. Robinson, who was one of my idols, and I'm tongue-tied.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Bogart, Cagney, Robinson, you know, my idols growing. Pat O'Brien, remind me to tell you the Cary Grant story. But so anyway, I'm sitting there. We're standing there talking to Elvis, and Colonel Parker, his manager, is sitting over there, and he says something to the assistant director, and the assistant director comes over to me and says, "You don't talk to Mr. Presley."
Oh,
and then he looks at me and he says, "Don't I know you?" I said, "I don't think so." He says, "Hey, look, kid, I know what you're doing. Just be cooler about it."
Oh no.
Anyway, I am in the movie. There's
you
a
are.
Scene, and actually a lot of people know this scene. There's a scene in the movie where Elvis goes up to this little boy who happens to be Kurt Russell.
Oh, gosh.
And he says, "Hey, kid, you want to kick me in the shins? I'll give you a quarter or whatever." And so the kid kicks him in the shins. There are two points in that movie where I walk at 21 years old, walk right behind them, and then I walk back the other way because of the editing. You see me twice. So I did make it.
That was your big film debut.
Yep, that was my film debut.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with author Michael Druxman. You can find out more about Michael and his latest book, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, from the secret files of Harry Pennypacker at his website, onceuponatimeinhollywood.com.
But let me tell you this Cary Grant story.
Please do.
I was working on, you know, when I would do my books on Hollywood, I would send out letters, I'd send out letters to people I wanted to interview. And I think I was doing one on movie sequels, and I was doing a chapter on there on the Topper movies, and Cary Grant had been the star of the first one. And so I sent out, I think on Monday, Tuesday morning, again in the office, first thing the phone rings. Michael Druxman, yes? One moment for Cary Grant.
Oh, my God.
And he gets on the phone, and I'm not prepared for that, you know. And I'm, I sounded like a blithering idiot. But he gave me a very nice interview. He was very charming, and, you know.
Wow, you really rubbed shoulders with some of the biggies.
Oh, yeah.
And Bogart, too, I know you met.
No, I never met.
Okay.
I wish I had.
Yeah.
Bogart and Cagney are the two I never met. Mm. Never met Orson Welles. I would love to have met Orson Welles. A good friend of mine who passed away was Dan O'Herlihy, who had done, he played Macduff in Orson Welles' Macbeth,
mm-hmm.
and knew him quite well. So he gave me a lot of good Welles stories, but never met Welles. I met Edward G. Robinson, who I was lucky enough to meet. Broderick Crawford, who is I became friends with. I also got to know quite well George Raft. I love the gangster stars.
Yeah. Well, gangster movies were big back then.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I Howard Keel became a client of mine. I love, you know, the musicals. And
so yeah. What are your thoughts on today's Hollywood compared to that day in Hollywood, that era?
Well, are you talking about the kind of movies they're making or just working there?
Both. The whole business. I mean, it has changed so much.
Oh, yeah.
The actors and actresses are just completely different than they were back then as well.
That's true. It's difficult. Somebody asked me recently, do you think any of today's people will become legendary,
mm-hmm.
like a John Wayne or a Bogart or, And, you know, my first response is, well, ask me in 50 years.
Right.
The only person who's, and he's sort of on the verge of retiring, who I would be willing to bet the farm on that will become a legend, it will be still be a legend 50 years from now, is Eastwood, Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the people who have become legends, it's their on-screen personas that have made them legends.
Mm-hmm.
They were all good actors. I mean, don't get me wrong, they were all good actors, but they all did roles within certain parameters. They were always basically playing the same role with different shadings,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, Bogart and Cagney and Robinson and Wayne. But you look at actors like Laurence Olivier or Paul Muni, who essentially became different people.
Mm-hmm.
They did not have a persona. They are not as well remembered today,
yeah.
unless you're really a film, really into it.
Yeah, They don't carry that legendary status.
No.
I see what you're saying. That's very interesting.
I mean, I think De Niro, Streisand, Streep, they're all fine actors. Will they be remembered 50 years from now? I don't know.
It's almost like they're more iconic, not necessarily legendary.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. You take a couple people that were very major, major stars back in the 40s and 50s, and Robert Taylor and Alan Ladd are virtually forgotten today.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't have, they were leading men, but they didn't have strong personas, screen personas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if it wasn't for Shane, nobody even know who Alan Ladd was today.
Well, what about the whole change in the industry itself? I mean, we're seeing so much of the independent film business coming in, foreign films are really hitting the scene. Where do you think Hollywood is going to find its new fit in this whole sort of international film market?
That's a very good question. I think Hollywood is, the problem, what happened was that when the multinational corporations started buying the studios, they put in these corporate types,
mm-hmm.
who they look at the study, they're looking at charts and things like that. What do the public want?
And bottom line,
yeah. And that's why you're getting 20 million sequels, and you're getting 20. Now they're remaking all these classic movies that should never be remade.
Right.
If you're gonna do a remake, remake a flop.
Right.
That didn't
do it right.
Well. Yeah, because if you remake a hit, it's always going to be compared to the memory of the first film.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God they've never remade Casablanca.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
And, but I read someplace they're going to remake The Wizard of Oz. Now, maybe that, I think would be a big mistake,
mm-hmm.
But back in the golden era, so I was lucky enough, I got to Hollywood in the early 60s. At the end of 63, and it was the very end of the studio system.
Mm-hmm.
They still had people under contracts to the studios and stuff like that, so I got to see a bit of that. But what happened then, the corporations took over, and you didn't have one person running the studios. You had somebody like Jack Warner or Harry Cohn or Zanuck running a studio, and they had an instinct for what the audience wanted. The people running the studios today don't have that. They just go by, let's do these studies,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you get so much junk. And that's why if you look at the Academy Awards for the last few years, all of the major awards have gone to either foreign-made films
yeah.
or independent
yeah.
films.
Yeah.
They may have had some studio financing, but they weren't studio films.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the big studios are beginning to worry about that? I mean, the Academy Awards don't necessarily hold that status. It doesn't hold the status it once did.
Well, it's still the number one award.
Yes,
it is. I mean, you know, you can win all the other awards, but if you don't win the Oscar, you know, that's still got the status. It's just that so many of the choices that have been made in recent years, you look at some of the best pictures. You know, they're so political on what the best picture is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Slumdog Millionaire is going to be remembered 10 years from now.
Yeah, you're not the biggest fan, and that was a big hit at the last awards.
Oh, I know. Best picture. It was the picture of the moment.
Yeah.
But you look back at, you know, I mean, I remember, I think one of the worst mistakes, I'm going back many years now, but you look back at the films that have been voted the best picture of the year, and I'll bet you, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, you haven't seen half of them. They're forgotten
mm-hmm.
because they were a film for the moment, but they really didn't have, they didn't last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was it, a few years ago, the Best Actor Award went to Roberto Bergini, is it the, you know? And he beat out so many more qualified people because he went to Hollywood and he campaigned. Campaigned, and it was afterwards people were embarrassed that they had voted him because, I mean, Ian McKellen had been up that year for Gods and Monsters, and I think Nick Nolte, I think, was up that year for a tremendous performance. And
mm-hmm.
but this guy was the clown. They thought he'd be fun, and he was, you know, And I'll tell you the worst mistake the Academy ever made was, I think it was the first year the Oscars were televised. They voted the Best Picture the greatest show on earth because they felt they had to give an Oscar to DeMille.
Oh, okay.
And that beat out Place in the Sun, High Noon, and Moulin Rouge, you know. And
that's pretty questionable.
Yeah, there's a lot of embarrassing if you look back in the history.
Yeah, it's there. Well, so have you seen any movies recently that you think sort of hold a candle to some of the oldies or just have that high standard?
Well, my favorite movie last year really was The Reader, with
mm-hmm.
the one that Kate Winslet won the Oscar for.
Yeah.
I think it was the best picture of last year.
Yeah.
You know, if it grabs me, you know, after seeing as many movies as I have, it really takes a lot to grab me. And I that had me from beginning to end almost.
Mm.
And I liked last year, I liked Frost Nixon very much.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Doubt was very good. People are going to hate me for saying this, but I think the most overrated movie of last year was The Dark Knight.
Oh, yeah.
I did not like that movie.
And it was huge.
Oh, I know. And Heath Ledger won the Oscar all that. And but I did not like that movie.
Really?
I thought it was boring.
Really?
I think one of the blessings and the curses that come along from this business is CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Because the blessing is now we can be taken to worlds that we could never see before, you know, and you can do pictures for a fraction of the money that like you could never shoot Ben-Hur today the way it was shot back in 1959 with cast 1,000. Pardon me. You would have to if you remade it today, you'd have to use CGI.
The new technology.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
Yep.
You know, the computer generated special effects.
Yeah, yeah. And it takes away from the realism of it.
Well, some of it's fine, but the problem is these directors say, you know, and you look at car chases today in action movies. They go on forever because, we have to do this effect. Now let's crash the car this way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just they just overuse it to the fact that the car chases and the action sequences get boring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, let's have a car chase but then let's tell the story. You know, let's get back to the story.
Not a half-hour car chase.
Yeah.
Right.
And I saw a couple last year that seemed like a half hour.
Yeah, I know.
You know? I saw a movie. I haven't seen one movie in a theater yet this year. I have seen a couple of 2009 movies on DVD, one of which I saw a few days ago, which I liked. It was a good, it's a good thriller called The International.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't do a lot of business, but there is a shootout in there that takes place in the Guggenheim Museum, which is a very good action sequence. And it's an intelligent plot, so.
So thumbs up from you.
Yeah, thumbs up.
So what has been your secret, really, in the longevity that you've discovered as a career in Hollywood? I mean, really, it's with the changes that have happened, it's amazing that you've lasted as long as you have in the industry.
Well, you don't give up. I'll tell you, when I was had been in Hollywood for about a month, I went to a seminar that was and Jack Lemmon was speaking at the seminar. And he said something that I've never forgotten. He said, the only people who should try to make it in Hollywood are the young, because young people are stupid. They cannot conceive of the fact that they can fail. And that's basically what you need. As you get older, you get wiser.
You're right. Naive.
You get that, and there's a certain, charm in naivete, unless you're, Bob, I'm going to go into that. I was going to say unless you're a politician. Sorry, I was going to say president, but.
Uh-oh, be careful.
Yes, I know. I'm in a blue county in a red state. I just stuck to it. I made a living doing my publicity, and I kept writing, and I never stopped.
Did what you had to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I made a good living.
So has there been any story that you haven't explored that you want to?
There's a true story that I would love to tell someday, but I'm not going to tell you what it is on radio because somebody might see
someone else will take it. Don't tell us.
But, while I was researching it, I came up with my the idea for my Dillinger and Capone script, Roger Corman made with Murray Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
But I might go back to it because it's an interesting story. Frankly, it's a matter, do I really want to do all the research?
Mm.
Right now I'm working on my memoirs. When I finish that, we'll see where I am.
Which must be incredible. I mean, the amount of stories that you have, you could probably be writing for years.
Yeah, that's the problem because, I also think to myself, when I finish it, is it over?
Right.
There's a thing, do I really want to finish this? I mean, when I send it out, is that going to be the end?
Right, right.
Yeah,
So is there anyone that you haven't worked with that you hope to?
That's still alive.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to. I think... It's to have been born 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier to have been part so that I could have met some of these people that, became idols, that I idolized growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Bud Abbott, which was a big thrill because he and Abbott and Costello were my, my heroes when I was
little. Of course.
Yeah, that was sort of a kick. And
so was your move to Austin, was that for writing? Was that because there's such a big industry, a film industry here in Austin?
No, I wanted to get out of Los Angeles because, and frankly, Austin is 37 to 40% less cost of living, and I figure I can write any place.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't actually sent a script out by hard mail for over 5 or 6 years.
Oh wow!
When I'm writing a script for somebody, I just send them the I put it in a PDF file and send it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So location with your writer is not a problem.
That's true. With the technology today, I mean, really, you could be anywhere on the planet.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
And I think though, if you're not established and you want to get into the business, seriously, you either have, on a serious basis, you either have to be in Los Angeles.
Really?
Once they know who you are, I think you can live any place.
So make your connections and then move.
Yeah, establish a rep and then move.
And then move on.
Yeah.
So we have your website for your new book as onceuponatimeinhollywood.com.
Right.
And so is this basically your personal website?
No,
or?
No, that's where you can order the book or you can order direct from Amazon.
Okay.
My personal website is Druxmanworks, D-R-U-X-M-A-N, works, one word, .com. And there I have, you know, there's a lot of pictures of me with showbiz friends on the front page, and I do a five-day-a-week blog. Still have to get my webmaster to update it that I've moved to Austin.
Oh, gosh.
But,
well, it was
a
recent move, so.
Yeah, we moved about 2 months. We've been in our house just under 2 months. And
will you miss anything about L.A.?
Yes.
What?
Cantor's Deli.
Oh.
You do not have a good deli here in Austin.
Mm-mm.
You know, and I miss having a yogurt. I love frozen yogurt, and the only good one you have is north, you know, up in North Austin, and so that's a jaunt. But the sushi is very expensive here.
It is very expensive
as opposed to because you're not on the coast.
Yeah, not on the
west
coast.
But
you're not going to miss the scene.
No, no, not too much, because the scene has changed so much. It wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah.
It stopped being fun. Stopped being fun in the 1980s.
Mm.
It really did, because that's when it all started to change. And you know, I did well during the 90s. You know, I did very well in the 80s and 90s. You know, because I was busy. You know, in 2000, it's just most of the people are, you know. I don't know these people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a nice place. It's
all
too cutthroat. It's not fun.
Do you think it will come back around?
No.
Really?
No. I think the only way to make movies on a cheaper basis is, and they'll never do it is to go back to the studio system. Mm-hmm. Because I think the problem is that your stars today, you know, your main star gets $20 million or more, $25 million a picture. And I think the only way to do it is to bring back the studio system where you put these people under contract, you know, and build their careers and at a lower rate, you know, so you're not paying them 20, you know, maybe you're paying them $2,000-$3,000 a week or something like that, or you know, a couple thousand a week.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got it. That's the only way you can get the costs under control. It'll never happen.
Yeah.
It'll never
happen. No.
But the funny thing is that most of these stars are not worth what they're paid.
It's an incredible amount of money.
My wife and I were talking about this the other day, and I mean, the only people, two people that I think, or three people that can open a movie, that means you will go to see this movie just because they're in it,
mm-hmm.
is Will Ferrell, Ben Stiller, and maybe Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
That means opening weekend. That doesn't mean that the picture will continue to make money if people don't like it. But people go see it because they're in it. I don't think there's any other star today that you can sell the movie based on their name. Now, Tom Hanks, you know, just came out in Angels and Demons. But that's Angels and Demons. You know, people are going to see that.
Yeah.
The fact that Tom Hanks is in it is wonderful. But I don't think these stars are worth the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, I was meeting with a producer yesterday, and you know, there's so many movies that could be made without a star.
Right.
And they still, you know, look at Slumdog.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like Hollywood is just putting out movies with the same people in it. Yeah.
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 It's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad.
Interesting business.
Yes.
Well, Michael, it's been great talking with you.
Oh, I've enjoyed talking with you, too.
Yes, we're going to have you back when you get those memoirs published.
I'd love to do it.
Great. So your website's, again, onceuponatimeinhollywood.com and druxmanworks.com. Did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share with our audience before we let you go?
Yeah. I'll give you my motto. It's never pass up any reasonable opportunity, because you never know where it will lead.
Those are wonderful final words. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, that's been Michael Druxman. His latest book, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, From the Secret Files of Harry Pennypacker, is out now. And as mentioned, the website's onceuponatimeinhollywood.com and drexmanworks.com for more on Michael himself and all of his other endeavors. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this interview. Such an interesting book and very interesting man. So do check out the websites and look for this book in your local bookstore or through Amazon. So I want to thank you for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live today. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.